So when we looked at those two groups, what really started to emerge was this idea that there are kind of like two worldviews out there when it comes to people that are not really pursuing a Christian perspective of spirituality in their life, but they're open to spirituality. And that was kind of a pre-Christian mind and a post-Christian mind. And so we have kind of like both of those natures. And C.S. Lewis actually talked about this. We've been trained to be really efficient and effective, to be able to share the gospel accurately, efficiently, to as many people in as short a period of time as possible. The problem is with the spiritually curious, they're probably not going to come to a conclusion in one conversation. So we have to be committed to these people, or also realize that I am one stop in a journey that God has them on and is engaging them on, and that's okay.
Welcome to the Upwards Podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace. Today, I have a conversation with Mark Matlock, author of Faith for the Curious, a book that shares data, insights, and next steps to help you navigate the spiritually curious where they are in their own faith journey. Mark is a researcher at Barna and has authored over 20 books. He's also the executive director of Urbana 2025 for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. He co-authored Faith for the Exiles, 5 Ways for a New Generation to Follow Jesus in Digital Babylon. This is a pivotal book during the 2020 pandemic, and we go in depth on the book and what it means for this new generation. Now, on to the conversation. Well, I'm here today with Mark Matlock. He is the author of Faith for the Curious, a great book that I finished over spring break, sitting by the pool, which was really fun. Mark, tell us a little bit about Faith for the Curious. Where did this book kind of come from? I know that you had been a co-author for Faith for Exiles. How did this kind of new material, new kind of book come about in your sphere?
Well, you know, I started noticing as I was looking at a lot of the research we were doing at data for other groups, that there was this, what appeared to be 80 million Americans. It turns out it's a lot more than that. But there were about 80 million Americans I was watching. I was going, you know, they don't act the way a lot of us think that non-Christians, unchurched people act in terms of spiritual things. And the things that they said that they believed didn't line up with a lot of what I'd say the majority of us believe when we think about people that are outside of the church. And I started kind of like poking at that a little bit. And through some work specifically with the American Bible Society that we were doing on the state of the church and looking into kind of how the Bible's perceived in the United States, that was kind of where I first became really aware of this group. And so I decided to probe a little bit deeper in that and try and understand what really are the factors that make these people different. Are they different? And what could we learn from that as a church that might help us engage the people around us? And what we found is that there is this really large group of people. They make about 67% of the unreached or unchurched population that are what we call spiritually curious or curious skeptics. I'll explain what that is later, but they're in this curious kind of category of high level curiosity.
Yeah. What did you learn from, I also read, I mean, Faith for the Exiles was such a great book. I mean, it came out at like the perfect time, I think, as things were drastically changing with millennials kind of aging.
Yeah, it turned out to be a prophetic book in ways we didn't anticipate it being. Yeah, it's still still doing really well, which is surprising. It came out just before the pandemic, about 3 months, and pretty much, you know, you watch all book sales just basically tank once the, you know, the pandemic's, because when people go through trauma, they can't read. You know, that's a really interesting thing that that I've learned in working with people that are going through personal burnout or whatever, is that reading is really difficult for them. And so there was a period of time when there was nothing, but then groups started calling me saying, hey, we're reading your book as a textbook for class or whatever, since, you know, we're all meeting on Zoom. Could you meet with us? And I just started doing all of these little Zoom ends with people. And as an author, it was really powerful to interact with people who had been reading the book, you know, some for pleasure, but most of them out of requirement to read. And it was with everybody, teenagers, college students, seminarians. I mean, it was really, really fun to do that and read through that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so fun. It was such a really pivotal book. I think you know, seeing kind of the millennials kind of aging out. They're kind of in a weird, I think those younger millennials are kind of a weird kind of demographic anyways, because they're kind of, they bump into that Gen Z thing, but they're not fully Gen Z, but they're not kind of that older millennial. They're kind of in a weird space. And so it was really, I think, a really interesting book to see how to re-engage. You know, I think there was such a dip during the pandemic with engagement. You know, everyone saw numbers kind of plummet, whether it was in a church or parachurch ministry, wherever. And so, you know, we're still in the process of building back into that. A lot of places are. And it was such a pivotal book, I think, for somebody. So thank you so much for writing it. And I think God's providence in when it was released and how it was released was really great.
Yeah, well, and I think while that book really focuses on discipleship of teens and how we're helping form them in faith to be more like Jesus, this book really looks at how are we, like what shifts in digital Babylon, you know, are required for us to evangelize in this era. You know, I think that's where the two are related, even though they weren't directly related.
Yeah. So, and Faith the Curious, you talk a little bit around just a couple of things. And so it'd be helpful, I think, for the future, kind of our next kind of conversation pieces, maybe to define a couple of things. So you guys have measured something around engaged Christians at Barna for a long time.
Yeah.
So I'd love to explore that a little bit. What is an engaged Christian? How do you measure how somebody of faith is actually engaging into maturity, discipleship, formation? What does that look like?
Yeah, it's become a lot trickier to do because people's, you know, spiritual beliefs are really fluid and they don't always fit into really neat boxes. So you can't just say, do you consider yourself to be a Christian? Because if you do that, you get about 83% of the U.S. population go, yes, I identify as a Christian. But then when you start asking questions about what they believe will happen to them after they die, what is the basis of their salvation, you realize, okay, it's theologically all over the map. And even doing this Faith of the Curious research, trying to pin down people's supernatural beliefs even more broadly was very difficult because, you know, we even found with people that were like spiritually skeptical, like almost half of them believed that when they died, they were going to be accountable to some higher power for the way they lived on earth. So it was there was a very Judeo-Christian kind of, you know, view that they had of, even though they weren't a Christian, that when you ask them, what do you think happens when you die? They thought, I'm going to be accountable to God for the way that I've lived. And it was like, wow, you know, like that doesn't match up with these other things that you said you believe. So beliefs are really fluid, but we look at a few things. What we try to do at Barna, because we're trying to ask as many questions as we can, we've tried to figure out how can we ask the least possible amount of questions and get to the right audience. So for instance, we used to have, I think it was 9 factors. I could be wrong on this. Like 9 factors that would like qualify somebody is what we would say having a biblical worldview or an evangelical worldview, which that word's become loaded. So we've had to play around with that a little bit too. Now we've gotten that down to 4 factors because we found that if there are 4 questions that you answer affirmatively, the others kind of fall in line. And so we were able to save questions. So sometimes people will look at our criteria and go, oh, wow, that doesn't seem like very much, but it actually does a really good job at getting to the group of people that we're looking at. And so that has to do with the frequency of their church, how central their faith is to them, and the idea that they've made a commitment to Jesus Christ that's still meaningful in their life today. So those are some of the factors that we use to put somebody into a practicing Christian format. Sure. Just because somebody's a practicing Christian doesn't necessarily mean that all their theological beliefs are all in order, though. A lot of times they're in process, but they're actively pursuing their faith, doing the things that we would consider identify them as a Christian.
In the book, you talk a little bit about the spiritually open. I believe that was kind of the phrase that we were using. And then the kind of the spiritually skeptic, those kind of 2 different things.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about those 2 different kind of tags, if you will, on kind of how people are, you know, interacting. And what have you found about kind of the difference between kind of those different 2 types of people?
Yeah. So what we did was we measured people along kind of 2 axes. So one was just their belief in the supernatural. So we put practicing Christians all the way to the right of that horizontal axis. And then we measured curiosity on a vertical axis. And we used a scale from the literature that measure two factors of curiosity, stretching and embracing. So stretching is how much you actively like seek out new information and new ideas. Embracing is how well you do sitting with ambiguity and new ideas. So when they're being presented to you. So how much do you embrace that moment? How much are you actively stretching? So from that, we were able to kind of like, you know, dial in a curiosity number. And what we found is that there was this large group of people that kind of had similar behaviors and beliefs that we called the curious. But if we upped the level of curiosity, two really distinct groups emerged. One was the curious skeptic, and one was what we call the spiritually curious. So it does help sometimes to talk about those two groups more distinctly. But broadly, we're talking about this larger category that includes even some with this medium curiosity. But maybe because of the way they answered some questions, it tended to pull them into a more muddier space. So when we looked at those two groups, what really started to emerge this idea that there are kind of like two worldviews out there when it comes to people that are not really pursuing a Christian perspective of spirituality in their life, but they're open to spirituality. And that was kind of a pre-Christian mind and a post-Christian mind. And so we have kind of like both of those natures. And C.S. Lewis actually talked about this in some letters that he wrote to an Argentinian priest. It's called the Latin letters. I don't think they were translated until like the 70s. So they're actually not really well known in the C.S. Lewis kind of canon. But he's writing about, and part of the deal was the priest didn't speak English and C.S. Lewis didn't speak Spanish, but they both spoke Latin. So they wrote to each other in Latin, as you do. And they and so these letters were discovered, they were translated, and they were talking in one of them about this idea of post-Christianity. And this is like in, you know, 1953, I think. C.S. Lewis is writing about the situation in Europe. And he's basically saying that like a lot that's never been built on is different than a lot that's been built on and cleared. They both don't have a structure on them, but they're not the same thing. And he describes pre-Christian and post-Christian as that lot. He says like there's a difference between an unmarried woman and an adulteress, right? And he's saying there's a difference between these two things, even though they are maybe, you know, similar in a lot of factors. And that really helped me see what was going on with these two groups. I stumbled upon this actually as I was trying to understand post-Christianity and found these early writings of C.S. Lewis that were really insightful, and they helped kind of shape what's going on. So we have a lot of people that have no concept of what Christianity is today. They're that pre-Christian mind, that spiritually curious mind. Very cursory. And then you have the curious skeptic that usually has a little more knowledge about the church, about Christianity, but has not really been introduced to Jesus in a way that is compelling. And so they're spiritually open and curious about the supernatural world, but it's rooted in skepticism as opposed to maybe like action. So like when we looked at things like reading tarot cards or seeing a fortune teller or spiritual medium or advisor or pursuing mindfulness, the spiritually open were all over the place pursuing these different kinds of supernatural activity. The curious skeptic was a little bit less experimental, but they still had curiosity around what could possibly be out there. They're just not sure that that can actually ever be known.
Yeah. I think of, campus ministry world. I mean, you have some, you're diving into that with InterVarsity here. And, you know, I think a long time, you know, the strategy for a lot of campus ministry group was, you know, go for the unchurched, the agnostic, the person that is very far from faith or, you know, whatnot. And I think this interesting middle group and the two different groups within that structure that you described, that skeptic, I think is, you know, bridging into kind of that former group that we would have kind of gone said like, hey, here's a target kind of audience of that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about the open versus skeptic dynamic and what tools or how would you maybe dive into conversation with individuals based upon kind of, you know, what you've learned within the structure, how would you, if you're ministering to, let's say, somebody that's more open versus somebody who's skeptic, how would you dive into that?
Yeah, well, I want to throw out one other group, okay? And that is what we call the naturalist in the book, In Faith of the Curious. Well, yeah. We talk about the naturalist. The naturalist is a lot more of the archetype that people have in their mind of what a non-Christian is, right? They are antagonistic toward Christianity. They don't believe that there's anything out there except, you know, science rules, that kind of a thing. That's more of that natural mindset. They basically say, I don't believe that anything exists beyond what I can experience with my five senses. When I die, my soul is just extinguished. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing else. That group actually makes up a very small percent of our population, only about 10%. And that's really important because we often, you know, think that we're going to encounter that. Now, the curious skeptic can be a little hostile, but if we understand where they're coming from, they don't have to be, right? So the first important thing to realize about both groups is that they're both open to spirituality. They're both interested in it and leaning into it, not necessarily Christianity. And so our starting space should always be assuming that God is already at work in their life somehow. And this kind of plays off of Faith for the Exiles, where we talked about screens discipling, this idea that we have that most people are taking their questions to Google or ChatGPT now before they ever bring them to a person. So I never assume when I'm talking to a person that God has not already been at work in their life. So that's the first thing that I want to discover is where is that at? And I find that just kind of being interested in that, even though I don't have like special questions or whatever to probe at that necessarily. But I find that just being open to that tends to open people up, even just my approach, right? Just the posture of wanting to know everything about this person's journey. But I think that's really important because I think a lot of Christians, especially those that are just, you know, kind of, you know, getting kind of spiritually charged up on Sunday at church, and then going into the world, they tend to think there's more resistance or hostility. There's actually more resistance and hostility to our method of evangelism than there is what's behind our evangelism. And I think that's the important thing is our evangelism methods have been trained. We've been trained to be really efficient and effective, to be able to share the gospel accurately, efficiently to as many people in as short a period of time as possible. The problem is with the spiritually curious, they're probably not going to come to a conclusion in one conversation. So we have to be committed to these people or also realize that I am one stop in a journey that God has them on and is engaging them on, and that's okay. And so just having that posture going in, but what I have found is that people have a powerful spiritual backstory. And so going in assuming that opens up conversation because I find that, you know, my wife would always tell me, Mark is a party foul to talk about spiritual things when we go to neighborhood parties. And I go, look, I'm not bringing this up. They're bringing it up with me. Right. When they find out what I do, they want to talk about these things. And so I think there are so few places for people to truly explore spirituality with other people that they're willing to do it anywhere. You know, my wife and I have found that we go to New York a lot. Our daughter lives there and I've served in ministry there for the last 7 years. When we go to New York, if we eat our meal at the bar instead of at a table by ourselves, 85% of the time, and I've actually counted, 85% of the time, we will have a spiritual conversation with somebody at the bar without even trying. Like we're not even, I'm not even there, like trying to make it happen. I'm not oriented. Some people go, well, Mark, you're a super evangelist or whatever. I'm really not. I am the most reluctant evangelist you could possibly find out there. But I found that by being interested in spiritual things in other people's lives, it just leads to these kind of conversations. So a lot of it is just getting our posture right when we engage people, not expecting hostility, but assuming that there's something there to explore.
Yeah. I think the long-term vision is really interesting, right? I think it is about relationship and how can those relationships flourish in the long haul in a way that, you know, we're on a journey with folks and it's going to take a long time. And are you okay not necessarily seeing kind of the measured fruit that we've seen in the past, right? Of some of the methodology that we've seen in the past, but to say, oh, this, you're in the long haul. I mean, as a student who might be involved in, you know, campus ministry group, enters as a freshman, may not fully, you know, come to faith until their 20s or 30s or 40s. But, you know, these seeds that are planted, what we're cultivating here, the openness to the conversation, I think really matters for folks.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I wrote Faith of the Curious, one of the hardest things for me to do was not turn it into a book of tricks, right? Like, here's a bunch of tactics you can use to like, you know, engage your neighbor or your family member or whatever. And I also realized that I'm telling people stories, and I went to every person that I talk about in the book and asked for permission.
Yeah.
And there are a few that had passed away, but there were some people that, you know, but I realized a lot of them are going to read this book. I have to honor them. And if they think that, well, Mark's just trying to convert me or whatever, then I've failed at what, you know, even though I would love for them to know Jesus. So I had to really think about that a lot as I was writing the book, realizing that many of the people that I encounter might pick up the book and read it. And a few of them have already. And it's been interesting how that's opened up conversation. But trying to make sure that we realize this is not a game that we're playing with somebody's life. We are introducing them to Jesus Christ, Savior of the world. And so I just think it's really important that, and that's a posture shift, I think, that has to change. We have to be really committed to people and not just their conversion. And I think that's the harder thing that we haven't always been trained or taught how to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, the buzzword around deconstruction around faith has been going on for a while. It really got legs around the pandemic. Those that are deconstructing, it feels to me like they're a little bit more in the curious skeptic kind of category of things.
Yeah, that would be the space. Yeah.
Yeah. How have you seen churches, ministries, you know, examples of different ministries really embracing those that are on that journey and walking through well with them?
Yeah. You know, this is one of the harder things to watch happen. One of the things that we did in our research is we actually used something called a need for closure scale, which measures how comfortable we are with ambiguity versus certainty. Because when we have a need for closure, it means that we're looking for answers. We're looking for things that satisfy that ambiguity that we're feeling or that sense of being unsettled. And it's interesting, if you look at some of the rising trends, you know, theologically in churches, a lot of them have to do with some of these ideas of theological certainty or closed systems of theology, right? That lean less toward mystery or I'm not really sure about that and kind of go toward answers. And some of it is because we measured this, and practicing Christians have a higher need for closure than the general population by about 10 percentage points, and among the spiritually curious by about 26 percentage points. So what I realize is we have an environment, a culture, our churches that is going to be quick to answer questions. We're going to be more comfortable with answers that maybe aren't as satisfying as they should be to a curious or a mind that thinks differently, right? That's bringing different questions to the text. So, you know, as a kid, I had one of those little posters that said, you know, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. And to be honest, that was actually pretty true of me for most of my Christian life as a young person, you know, that God said it, I believe it, I'm good with it. But I started encountering people who that wasn't enough, you know, just because God said it in the Bible didn't mean that that settled it, you know, and it didn't mean that people believed it. And so it was like, whoa, wait a minute, you know, you don't believe this. So there's nothing wrong with having a high need for closure. There's absolutely nothing that's pejorative about that, but it does something we need to be aware of, whether we become that as a community or whatever. But that means that when young people are asking questions, if we're not allowing those questions to actually be a part of our own formation, right, where we're letting it push up against us a little bit, we give an answer that can be very unsatisfying, or we can be frustrated by the volume of questions and we're off-putting. And all of a sudden, what a young person believes is, you know what, this isn't a safe place for me to ask questions and to doubt. And then they take their doubt on the road. And I would much rather have a young person journey with me and a Christian community in their doubt than to do it on their own and Google or ChatGPT. And right. So I think that's something we just need to be mindful of. And it shows up in our artwork. You know, the Christian church is not known for abstract art. We like art that's real concrete. We know exactly what's going on in the thing. And that's would be art that appeals to people with a high need for closure, right? I don't like the ambiguity of what that art is saying. So I need it to be more explained and definitive. And so you see how culturally this, you know, can create a real, for people that are curious, it could be really boring. There might not be anything engaging about our church services because of that. And I think even within our churches, I talk in the book about pioneers and settlers, that within our churches even, because the church is mixed with a lot of people, but while those with a lower need for closure, and by the way, having too low of a need for closure can be a disaster too in a life, but there are people with a lower need for closure, and they sometimes are the rebels in the church. They're the ones that are always butting heads or challenging things. And we all know that person who just always brings in the random idea or politically doesn't align with the majority of the congregation or whatever. And some of these people do very well living in that space. And we need to see them as a real asset to our communities because they help us not get complacent in our spiritual life and our walk with Christ and keep that relationship dynamic. And they can also be really effective at reaching some of these curious people.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
Well, I want to transition our conversation a little bit into Gen Z, which is something I'm super passionate about here around campus. You know, starting Gen Z, and I think even in Gen Alpha, we see just demographically less people. You know, our population is shrinking, especially mm-hmm. with those two different generations. I think, which is interesting.
In the U.S.
In the U.S., yes. Yeah. In the U.S. Yeah. In the U.S. You know, a lot of colleges are really nervous right now about kind of this cliff and seeing mm-hmm. kind of what's coming and the amount of students that are available even in that mix. That has not been true here at UW-Madison. We had a record number of applications this last year and record number of incoming first-year students this fall.
Yeah, what you tend to see is that there's kind of like concentrations, you know, and so there are some that are going to really thrive during this season. There are some that are going to be pruned away, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So at Barna, you guys kind of describe Gen Z as the most diverse and spiritually connected generation.
Yeah.
How does this shape kind of their spiritual outlook? If you could kind of describe a little bit of kind of Gen Z as their spiritual outlook, what would that look like?
Yeah, so if I can take off my Barna hat for a moment, put on my Urbana hat. So, you know, I have the privilege of running Urbana 25 this year for InterVarsity, and it's been a really exciting couple of years to be involved in this. We would describe at Barna, I think Kerry Newoff may have been the one who coined this, but we describe Gen Z as being both in revival and retreat. So while there's a pulling away from kind of Christian norms among Gen Z, we're also seeing Gen Z leaning in and experiencing revival and just really being active. And there's a college ministry in Phoenix where we're having Urbana this year that I've been connected to. And they've got about 1,000 college students that meet every week at this church. They're not really sure why. You know, the pastor there is like, I don't really know what happened. Just all of a sudden, we got 1,000 students coming every Thursday. And it's been really exciting, though, to be a part of that group. And I visited there a few times and with their staff. But there's just something that God is doing right now with this generation. And we did a global research project at Barna studying Gen Z in 25 different countries that we did with World Vision, Biblica, and Alpha. And one of the things that we found is that while they are a diverse generation, for sure, they also have a lot more in common with each other than they do the generation above them in their own country. And so it just kind of makes you go, what is God doing? That mm-hmm. he's kind of created a commonality generationally, globally, right? And so as we go into this first all Gen Z Urbana, I'm sitting there going, what is going to be ignited in the imagination of these young adults when they come here and kind of see what God is doing around the world and begin imagining how they play a part in it. So while they are a diverse generation, there is a lot in common with them globally, and they are connected to one another. And so I think that's just a really, really interesting thing to look at and to see the way that God is moving among them. But they're, you know, especially in the United States, they're ethnically diverse. So we have, you know, one of the first generations to grow up in a kindergarten class where white was not the majority population, right? And so that's a huge shift in our culture, our demographics, and the way that they see the world. And, you know, in adolescent work, we always say, you know, students are kind of asking, you know, some basic questions, you know, what is my identity? What's my autonomy? What decisions are mine to make? Questions of belonging, who is my tribe? Who do I fit in with? And then questions of epistemology, what is my trusted source of truth? And while, you know, if you walk up to a seventh grader, he's not going to say, you know, what are you doing right now? Oh, I'm asking epistemological questions, but they are trying to figure out, what do I trust? Now, what's shifted is, while every generation that sociologists have studied go through kind of these, you know, answering these questions for themselves, the number of responses, options to the answers has really changed, right? So for most of us that are older, when we were asked questions of identity, you know, you really understood what your ethnic identity was, what your gender was. Now there are many flavors to choose from when it comes to gender fluidity. But even when it comes to race, a lot of people don't know which box to check because they're from a blended race. And so which one do I identify with, connect with? Where do I belong? You know, what is my purpose in life? For many of us, we had to answer those questions. Those of us, you know, Gen X and above, you know, we had maybe three options to the question, right? They have like 1,000. And so it's weird because we look at a generation that's very anxious. It's like, oh, I can understand their anxiety because they're afraid of answering the questions wrong. And most of us answer them without even really thinking about it too much. And I think that's one of the things that really defines, you know, this generation is this, the number of options, the access that they have to information. But what I love about Gen Z too is they're also starting to really understand the difference between knowledge and wisdom. And so while they realize that they can access data and information, they don't always know how to leverage it because of their life experience. And so this is where older generations have something really beautiful to offer, is we have this wisdom that we can help them with if we have humility. And I found that Gen Z, unlike millennials that were a little much more like, give me a seat at the table, Gen Z is a little bit more like a generation of best practices, where they're like, hey, tell me what you've learned. Tell me what can help me move ahead fast. I mean, they're less interested in co-creating and more interested in helping me, you know, not make mistakes that have already been made before. And so it's kind of an interesting thing. I've talked to a lot of leaders who said, wow, it was really interesting. I had this group of young college students in, and they just couldn't stop taking notes and asking me questions. And I thought I was going to be irrelevant as an older person. And I'm like, well, your humble posture of not trying to tell them things, but letting them access your experience, that's what they're engaging. And that's pretty exciting, because if we have a generation that understands wisdom earlier and the value of it, they have the ability to do some really incredible things in our churches.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about connectedness with Gen Z. I mean, they are ultra connected, right?
And yet feel isolation and loneliness.
Right.
Like nobody else. I mean, it's incredible how many of them report loneliness as one of their experiences. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because we have just a high school graduate and then two others in high school. And so it's interesting to see their connectedness. I would say they're connected first. But there's also this pushback against kind of technology for some as well. Mm-hmm. Like they're like, hey, we're not, you know, I'm not doing the Instagram, TikTok thing, or, you know, I'm
flip phones have kind of made a comeback with a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, there's a surge in flip phones.
Yeah. And it also is a formational question. Yeah. I mean, it's also a formational question, I guess, because, you know, I've seen through, you know, being connected with other high school students, this really strongly passionate connection to, I would say, virtual mentorship, you know, somebody that's on YouTube, a theologian, let's say, or even a culturally kind of Christian, well-known type of a person has a podcast and that's kind of their discipleship formational person.
Yeah. There's no relationship there, but it's,
yeah,
but it's very intimate. Yeah. In a way.
Yeah. And yet they're not necessarily connecting, not always, but not, some maybe are not connecting as well locally to like an embodied kind of dynamic of things. How has the shift in kind of the connected generation even shifted from the millennials, right? They were kind of the first to experience all this. The self, you know, smartphone was, you know, really part of their journey. Mm-hmm. What would you say as kind of a wisdom thing to pastors, other ministry leaders who are listening in around how do we navigate this with kind of that Gen Z group?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So let me go back to Faith for Exiles for a moment. So for those who don't know, Faith for Exiles, we studied why young people were staying. So David, it was the third book in a trilogy that David had done. I'd been involved in the other two kind of in the background, but it was Unchristian and then You Lost Me, where we studied. And I was really involved in the doing the analytics on You Lost Me, where we're trying to understand why are young people leaving. Everybody was reporting that young people were leaving the church. We didn't know why. Are they all leaving for the same reasons? And then, you know, the great thing about doing research is that one project always leads to another. And what we found in there was, well, there's this group of students that isn't leaving and they're staying connected. Like, we didn't ask them very many specific questions. So Faith for Exiles was really an exploration of those that stayed to see, is there something we can learn about that? And we came up with kind of five factors of resilience that we felt contributed to that based on the research that we did. And one of them, the second one, was meaningful relationships. And this was probably, for me, one of the bigger surprises, because we had these two categories, what we called resilient disciples, were really growing in their faith, leveraging scripture and a relationship with Jesus to live in the world today. And then there were these habituals, that we called them, that were like going to church with the same frequency as the resilient disciples, but they were not reporting the same experiences, significant things as the resilience. And there was a real difference between the two. And so on that meaningful relationships, I thought, well, why are the habituals going to church? And I thought that it's going to be relationships, right? There's friends there, whatever. That proved not to be true. That resilience had significantly, by double digits, gaps, difference between habituals and resilience in their experiences at church. And so, you know, after one of our early presentations to a group of pastors, I was in the bathroom and there were two pastors like in stalls that were talking to each other about the presentation. So I just was really quiet listening to them talk. And one of them said, you know, we do all that stuff, you know, like there really wasn't anything new here. And I was sitting there shaking my head going, you're missing the point. The point, you may think you're doing this stuff, but it's not being felt. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we have to lean into really knowing the generation. One of the dangers of doing generational research I found is that people want to use the research to create for the generation rather than still getting to know the generation mm-hmm. and involving them in the creation of things. And the problem is that we can get things really wrong, right? Like we can misunderstand the anxiety that they're experiencing, right? There's a difference between being anxious because of an overwhelming number of choices and also being anxious because you don't know what your purpose is. And so, you know, if we get it wrong, we can actually keep them from finding their purpose because we're worried about overwhelming them. And yet that would be the thing that would actually help them overcome some of their anxiety. And so we can often misread the data and try to program for that or create around that rather than letting them be an active participant in what we're doing. The data should show us they see the world really different. They are bringing mm-hmm. a new imagination to the church and the world that we do not have. And so like for Urbana as an example, I'm not going to tell the generation what God wants them to do to fulfill the Great Commission through their generation. I'm going to tell them what God is at work right now, and we're going to show them like stories of where God is using people around the world, and we're going to let God work with them and their imagination to figure out how they live into that, right? And I think that's a posture difference that we have to take toward the generation, because I think at church, we think that we're connecting people to people, and we're really not. And I saw this with my daughter when she started on social media, maybe a little bit earlier than she was legally allowed to, because I was kind of doing an experiment in my home. She was at my lab.
Yeah.
And I realized we're both using the same tools, but we're using them for really different outcomes and purposes. Where I was using social media to maintain existing relationships that I had in the real world, she was using them to find new relationships and new communities to be a part of. And so, and that's where I sat there and thought, we have to, as a church, recognize generational imagination and live into it. God uses young adults for whatever reason, young people, to accomplish his purposes, always has. And we need to really be making sure that we're taking advantage of that in our church as a part of the body, as opposed to marginalizing it or saying when you're older and you're starting to tithe more, you can have a say in some of these things. We need that generational imagination.
Yeah. What would be your hope for Gen Z in the next 5 to 10 years? Like, what 5 to 10 years from now, what would you say, okay, if we do these things or we help this generation in these ways, this could be maybe the outcome of that. What would be some of those kind of tools in the toolbox that you would do to try to maybe press into an outcome, let's say long-term?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, Gen Z is coming into a time when there's a lot of disruption, right? And there's a lot of things. So I would pray that they would find more peace and stability in the future. I pray that their relationship with Jesus, that for many of them is very fresh and new and innocent, that it would only grow deeper and stronger, that they would make the jump from being a spiritual child to a spiritual adult. And I think we have to understand the path to adulthood has changed. I think that's one of the big findings in our research, and other friends of mine, Dr. Steve Argue at Fuller, good friend. He and I just went through some research that he did that is looking at 7 transitions of emerging adulthood. Amazing, amazing content that's going to be rolling out over the next few years. But we've got to understand the path to adulthood has changed. And that means that our role as adults, parents, leaders changes in how we support this generation. And so I hope that we can solve that for them and with them.
That's great. Well, Mark, thank you so much for being on the Upwards podcast. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah,
this is such a great conversation. Where can people find you on the internet? How do people connect with you?
Oh, I don't really have a great way to do it, but I if you go to markmatlock.com, I do have a mailing list that I infrequently communicate on. Facebook, I'm on Facebook, and I will do more at posting there. LinkedIn, all those places. I'm not great at Instagram, but I do stuff on Instagram too.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, thank you for audience for tuning in. We really appreciate Mark being on the podcast, and go in peace.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses so that all may flourish.